You're listening to Frame 25, a monthly micro edition of the Brightwall Darkroom podcast in conversation with and sponsored by our friends at Gallery. Every month we pick a title from Gallery's curated library and zoom in on a moment to better see the whole. I'm Veronica Fitzpatrick.
And I'm Chad Perman.
And today we're looking at a moment from another of Ronaldo Marcus Green's picks, and it's Gus Van Sant's 1997 coming-of-age classic, Good Will Hunting. I think we can say it's a classic.
It is a classic now.
Yeah, we're pretty far away from 1997.
So far away, sadly.
This is famously written by and co-starring Matt Damon as the eponymous Will Hunting and Ben Affleck as his BFF Chucky Sullivan.
Oh, wow. I didn't know they wrote it.
Come on.
Yeah, that's kind of the whole thing about it. That's why I love that you called it Gus Van Sant's Good Will Hunting. Because,
well, you know, when I was writing that blurb, I was kind of like, it feels a little false to put it that way. And when I was rewatching the film last night, even in the credits, there's like this way in which when we first see like Will and Chucky leaving Will's like horrible South Boston apartment,
Yeah.
The like image kind of lingers with the writing credit in this way that I think we usually only see that signature credit given to the director.
Yes. And I'm one of those nerds who listens to the commentary on stuff. So he said that was a total accident that lined up with that shot of them right as their names come up.
That's crazy.
But then they teased him. They're like, oh, don't worry. You know, Gus got the God level shot of, you know, the helicopter flying into the city.
Yeah.
So it's very clearly a Gus Van Sant film. And I can make many, many cases about why, he helped that movie be way, way better than it would have been.
Okay, make your best case right now.
I was a huge Gus Van Sant person. I actually ran a Gus Van Sant website in college.
Wow. Drop the URL.
Oh, it's GeoCities, so it's long gone. He got into this kind of weird mid-period where he did like Finding Forrester after this. So he kind of got a little mainstream for a while. Well, I guess he did Psycho after this, so not that mainstream. But I think that his sensibilities are so... In Finding Forrester, they're completely gone. I can't find them anywhere, pun intended. But in Good Will Hunting, I just feel like some of the directorial decisions they made, you know, these guys, Matt and Ben, they certainly didn't know how to direct a movie. Mm. And the script was, you know, I think it's really, really great movie in so many ways. But I think that that script could go so bad if the directorial framing of various things and some of the things in the commentary that he was saying about how he was using light and the music, which I'm going to talk about a lot. I just think, you know, that having the score, the sound higher up in the mix than you normally hear. And just various little things that he did. I don't know. It's like my favorite mainstream movie maybe ever. So,
oh, that's a really cool way to put it.
Yeah.
When I was rewatching it, I was also trying to think. I mean, obviously, they won for best screenplay.
Yes.
It's thought of as a film that's like renowned for the screenplay, for the writing, and for launching their careers, which have been so like long and decorated.
They're still here.
They're still here. And they were pretty young. I mean, I think he was 24. Is that right? When they completed the screenplay, but 28 by the time the film came out.
Yeah. Famously, the mythos is, you know, he wrote it as like for a Harvard playwriting class or something.
Yeah. Right.
But yeah, by the time they'd actually like shopped it around and had it rejected by Miramax.
Yes.
And then Kevin Smith, of all people, said, no, Miramax, you need to make this. And so they took it up again.
I know.
That's always a weird credit that pops up.
Yeah. It's a weird sort of process. I know. I was sort of scanning like the thank yous and loved seeing Harmony Korine's name pop up. Yeah. As the guy that Will like runs into in jail.
That's a wonderful moment.
Yeah. Do you want some of this ass, Harmony Korine? Perfect role. Also, Terrence Malick as like the friend who suggested the actual ending of the film. Very cool.
Yeah.
Takes a village.
Yeah, and it does. And I think Gus brought a lot to the village, but I think everybody brought their parts. And also, he was still more in the improvisational mode. So it's like mainstream, but with clear improvisation in it, not just from Robin Williams, who actually toned it down a bit. Most of Casey Affleck's lines, whatever you may or may not think of that guy at this point, were improvised. And they're like, he created this character where you could basically have him say anything and it just works because he's just so off the wall, you know? So a lot of that stuff is just ad lib in ways that feel so real. And that's what, you know, why it's so hard to pick a moment because there are so many real moments in this.
Yeah.
With the mainstream. Like, I guess the counterpoint would be imagine like a Christopher Columbus version of this film and how bad it would suck.
You know? Wow.
That's my best case for why it's a Gus Van Sant film as well as a Matt and Ben joint.
Yeah, it's good. Yeah. I mean, the Casey Affleck character, however, is called Morgan O'Malley, which I find absolutely unforgivable. as the child of a father from Brockton, Mass. I just thought it was pretty silly, not necessarily inaccurate. And mm-hmm. I actually just, as a super brief digression, watched, God, I can't think of the name of it now, but it's like the romantic comedy with Drew Barrymore.
Oh, I know all those.
You know what I mean?
Give me one detail and I can give you the name.
Well, it's all about the Red Sox.
Oh, yeah. Fever Pitch with Jimmy Fallon.
Fever Pitch with Jimmy Fallon. Like the worst chemistry in any rom-com I've ever seen.
It's pretty bad.
It feels like the whole thing is they lost a bet and had to make this film.
Based on a great Nick Hornby thing, too. A Nick Hornby book.
Yeah, I buy that. I mean, it feels Nick Hornby for sure. But, you know, that kind of rendition of Boston and South Boston and the kind of fandom and vulgarity of that part of the world. I don't know. It just feels super, super silly. Yeah. But that being said, I've always had a soft spot for this film. I was really glad when you picked it.
Oh, that's so nice to hear.
And really glad to revisit it for the pod.
And for me, my brief digression is there is no single movie on the planet that's changed and formed whatever my life the way this, I mean, this gave me my wife, my child's name, my favorite musician. So it's not hyperbole to say without this movie existing and without me seeing it for the third time on a certain day, I wouldn't have gone back to the apartment where my then ex-girlfriend lived to say, hey, I really fucked stuff up. You got to give me another chance.
Wow.
And it was from the screening of this movie at the no longer existing Metro Theater in Seattle. She lived just a couple blocks away.
Wow.
And I was like, you know what? I'm going over there right after this. I'm feeling the movie magic.
You had to go see About a Girl.
I got to go see About a Girl, which I will hold this up for all the podcast listeners to see.
I'll describe it.
This is what she gave me for Christmas this year.
What is that?
A little magnet that says, I got to go see About a Girl.
Oh.
Yeah.
Wholesome.
And then she also gave me a little Elliot Smith magnet here too. So
I love that.
Yeah, those are my talismans.
Well, that's the perfect segue to take us into the moment.
Yeah.
Tell me about Elliot Smith in this film for you and the moment that you've picked.
Yeah, so I had traveled down to California. My grandparents were alive at the time, and we would go down there at Christmas. I was in college. And for me, going to LA, I know for you, big cities and going to New York and access to movies is a whole thing in your life. For me, it's never been a thing. I could never see a movie early, but I had tracked this one, you know, Goodwill Hunting and like my Entertainment Weeklies. I knew all the updates and it was like, oh, it's playing for its theatrical run, so it can qualify for the Oscars. So I got to see it by myself. And I mean, I have such a distinct memory of being in the theater when this scene came on. The meet cute was so great. I mean, I was involved in that. I mean, I guess they weren't meeting, but the romantic, whatever feelings that were starting to build, I think is really well done with a mix of script and improvisation. But the second that I heard, like literally the second I heard Elliot Smith's voice on the mix and the fact that it was high enough in the mix that you could hear it, I said, well, who is this? Like, this is what I've been looking for my whole life in music. Mm. So I was actually distracted from that for most of the time. But that song itself, you know, famously, Elliot Smith is known for not the happiest, sunniest songs. And this is like the first exposure I ever had to him was this really probably the happiest, most romantic song he's ever even tried to write.
Which is
called Say Yes. Written famously for Elliot Smith nerds while his hands were doing their own thing while he was watching Xena the Warrior Princess. So
cool. Who hasn't had that experience? Am I right?
Yeah. And then in trying to figure out what moment to pick, because I basically just went to the Elliot Smith songs to see like, okay, I have to use an Elliot moment. I've been trying to find a way to talk about him on Bright Wall Dark Room for 11 years. So this is the moment. And I looked through all of them and I almost went with Between the Bars, which is in the scene with him and Skylar in the room. And it's very intimate and much different vibe. Mm-hmm. The reason I ended up picking this though is because I had never paid as much attention to what was happening in this moment. So they cut from the store where they're kind of trying on various props and making each other laugh. To eating it, I guess, like, oh, you know the name of this. You put this in the dock.
Yeah, it's the Tasty.
The Tasty,
it's in Harvard Square. It's a sandwich shop.
Is it still there?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
I don't know.
So they were at the Tasty. They're sitting there eating. And what happens is when it cuts to that, the camera starts this very slow push in. Mm. The music of the song starts to come a little bit higher in the mix. And then it had to have been timed up. I don't know how it couldn't have been. The camera reaches its final kind of like okay, we're going to get this close to them right at the exact same moment that they're leaning in for a kiss. And right in the moment when the most beautiful part of the song hits, like Say Yes, right as they go in for the kiss. And it's this wonderful little, in musical terms, like a step down minor chord and another minor chord. And then it hits this beautiful note, a pause, and Say Yes right after the C minor. Yeah. I'm just going to show you this. Listen to this. Listen to this beautiful. This chord.
Nice.
It's just musically, it's such a perfect moment. That's what movies are for me. Like the synchronicity there of everything. Credit to Gus Van Sant. Also to Elliott Smith. It's impossible for people to imagine this movie without his music in it. Mm. You know, the wonderful Oscar moment a few months later too. It just all ties together for me. And it's a love scene. And I like romance. I really like their chemistry because they were kind of semi-dating at the time. I remember.
They were fully dating.
Yeah. And he had written this character, he says in the commentary, based on his college ex-girlfriend giving her the line. Right. So he's basically recreated this experience of his, giving her the lines to say, and then made it this beautiful moment. So
yeah,
that's my moment. I could watch that scene over and over. Probably the Elliott Smith song I've listened to the most of my life.
It's such a sweet moment, and I was a big Elliott Smith fan in college for sure. Really, really loved his music for this film, Love, Miss Misery. Yeah. I will say my favorite Elliott Smith song ever and in the film is Angelus, actually.
Yes.
Followed maybe by Everything Means Nothing to Me, but I am totally, yes, you know, crazy about his presence in the film, which he really downplayed in interviews, but as you say, adds, yeah, like a totally critical emotional character to what might otherwise be a pretty standard fare, like pretty like masculine coming of age film.
Yeah, it definitely demasculinizes it.
Yeah, between that and Robin Williams's performance, which, yeah, is so complex. Oh,
how did I not mention him till now?
If you can stomach a few late 90s gay jokes, yeah, I think Good Will Hunting is a great thing to revisit.
Yeah.
With as much grace as you can extend to it. There's also, as you put it, all this kind of extra textual stuff going on in that, yeah, scene in terms of Matt Damon and Minnie Driver dating at the time and then it coming out. Her being surprised that they were no longer apparently seeing each other, him coming to the 1998 Oscars with Winona Ryder, I believe.
Yeah.
And there's stills on the internet.
One of them brought their mom. I felt like he maybe brought his mom, but I don't know. I might be thinking of Bradley Cooper still.
Okay. There's no one blames you. There's stills on the internet of Minnie Driver's face when he accepts, yes, the award, and kind of, you know, refers to her beautiful performance in it, and just the sort of like bittersweetness on, yes, her expression, I think, is so painful.
The 34 readers of the Gus Van Sant website were, that was hot gossip then in 1998. Yeah,
I bet. It stings me even now.
I kind of wonder where Minnie Driver is. I feel like Matt Damon and Ben Affleck are certainly still around, and Robin Williams obviously has passed. But for me, you know, I mean, I liked her in Circle of Friends, but for me, I think this was the best she was in any movie that I can think of.
I think she's brilliant. And, you know, I read that a producer, which I have to wonder if that's just shop talk for Harvey Weinstein, didn't think that she was beautiful enough to play this part.
Oh, that's got to be him, yeah.
That's like such a harrowing like tidbit of information. Yeah. But she's so smart, and I think believably smart, is critical to the Skylar role.
That's the thing.
For,
yeah,
sure. And is not something that you get in a lot of films about allegedly smart characters, I, yeah, would say, and particularly allegedly smart women. I mean, I feel like every day I watch a spy movie about someone who I don't believe can open their Gmail, and it's just like completely frustrating.
Yeah, no, she says in this moment here that she's going to Stanford and all this other stuff. And
yeah, med school.
It's very believable that, and I don't think you can bring that intelligence as an actor if you don't have some of that intelligence yourself as the actor, as the person. I feel like that'd be a hard thing to act. I know nothing about actual acting, so maybe you could say better than me, but I think it's really hard to act smart if you're not actually smart.
Well, I think years enough academia would prove otherwise.
Speaking of acting smart,
I,
yes,
do think, going back to the scene that you select and their kind of first kiss over dinner, I guess it is, there is a humor and kind of like an intelligence, sparky intelligence, yeah, to that exchange that I think does feel unique.
Yeah.
And cuts it apart from a lot of other first kiss scenes.
Yeah.
It's also funny that they're in the midst of eating something. And as such, it's, yes, sort of like the actually romantic analog to the "you taste like burger, I don't like you, yeah, anymore" moment from Wet Hot American Summer. I just love it.
Well, and after the kiss, yeah, they undercut it with a little joke of like, I think I got some of your pickle.
And exactly.
Yeah. I just saw all those little touches I love. So it just felt like you could really be eavesdropping on a scene that was happening at an actual bar that maybe Matt Damon would throw you off now because you'd be like, that's Matt Damon. But back then he was just lowercase Matt Damon.
That's right.
The whole idea behind Bright Wall Dark Room originally was like how movies play into our lives and all those kinds of things. And this one is so wrapped up in mine, I can't even pretend to be critical about it. But as objectively as I can get, I think it is a fantastic movie. I think the reputation maybe now is either people don't remember it that much or they remember it as the Ben and Matt wrote a movie and won an Oscar thing. Mm-hmm. It's so much more than that. Oh, I guess I should add, also influenced me deciding to be a therapist. You know, in the therapist community, we hate most portrayals of therapists on screen because they're all terrible, awful, manipulative, evil, messes themselves, whatever. This is one of the few, the Gabriel Byrne in Treatment one, which if you haven't seen that, my goodness, that's the perfect depiction of a therapist in my mind, at least in the therapeutic setting. And then Judd Hirsch in Ordinary People, and then Robin Williams in Good Will Hunting. Those are kind of the three accepted by the therapist community portrayals. Obviously, he breaks plenty of ethical protocols. But I mean, my goodness, to have a therapist like Robin Williams is in that thing would just be just amazing. It really did give me my whole life. Yeah, I could talk for 20 hours about this movie, so I'll stop. But a lot of my favorite people are in this movie, and my favorite person was connected to me after I saw this movie. And we built a whole life around this, and this is a big part of it. So that's my little moment.
Great.
Say yes.
Thanks for listening to another installment of our bite-sized monthly series in conversation with and sponsored by our friends at Gallery.
To join the conversation and see the rest of Rinaldo Marcus Green's list, sign up at join.gallery.com/BWDR.
Our theme music is composed by Chad Perman. This podcast is produced and edited by Eli Sands.